Well, good afternoon, everybody. I just wanted to kick off our first meeting of the Game and Fish Subcommittee in 2014 here today. I want to recognize that we did our darndest to turn down the temperature in this room. I know that the last week or so has been really hot, so hopefully you find it bearable. What we wanted to do is spend our time today on a brief overview of three different topics, moose population update from DNR, an invasive carp update from DNR, also deer population update, and then spend a little time doing a brief walkthrough with the DNR technical bill today. I don't anticipate that we're going to spend the full 2 hours here, but we do want to have a good discussion here, so I'd encourage questions from the subcommittee. And without further ado, if we could have DNR come up to talk about the moose population and run us through your presentation. And of course, please state your name for the record.
My name is Leslie McInnenley. I'm the Big Game Program Leader with Minnesota DNR. And thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you.
First off, in terms of the moose population, I just want to give credit to Glenn Delgidis. He's our moose project leader, and he's been giving a lot of these presentations. So this presentation that I'm giving today is actually something he pulled together for a recent hearing. Up on the slide in front of you, I've got a couple different graphics of Minnesota, and it depicts how our moose distributions have changed over time. The graphic on the left shows the general moose range as it was pre-settlement in European times. In the middle graphic depicts a point at time, you know, up even through the mid-80s, 90s, when we had two real distinct moose populations, a northwestern population and a northeastern population. And then the graphic on the right is basically the status as we are today. We have our primary moose range is now up there in the Arrowhead in that green area, and the hash mark is considered secondary moose range. So for this presentation, I'm going to touch briefly on how that switch went from those two populations to the primary population now in the east northeastern area, and I'll go into more detail about the current status of the population. So with respect to northwestern Minnesota, we used to have a fairly significant population of moose up there. In the mid-1980s, we had about 4,000 moose in the area, but over the course of a couple decades, we experienced a fairly significant population decline or population crash. And our last survey estimate in northwestern Minnesota, we counted fewer than 100 moose. And during the course of that population decline, you know, we had several management activities and some research efforts to try and figure out what was going on with the moose in northwestern Minnesota. The chart on the left depicts the population as it was declining from 1982 up to that last survey in 2007. I should say we do still have some moose there. We haven't counted just because of the effectiveness or the efficiency of surveys up there with such a small number. But the population, as it declined, it was a hunted population. So from the 1980s all the way up to 1996, we were basically scaling back the permits that we had available for harvest. And then in 1997, we actually closed the season. During that time frame, we also invested in some habitat management efforts, hoping that that might improve the trajectory of the population. And as I mentioned, we had some research efforts trying to look at what was going on in terms of the adult mortality. What we were seeing in the population in northwestern Minnesota is we were finding low adult survival and lower pregnancy rates, but fairly decent or fairly high calf survival. So we focused the research on adult mortality. And back during that time frame, you know, we had VHF radio collars, which just, you know, weren't up to the quality of some of the techniques that we have currently. And unfortunately, what you find when you use those collars is a lot of times we'd come in on dead moose, we'd find them about a week later, and the result is that a lot of the mortalities were unknown. Up there, that pie chart shows that 25% of the mortalities of those collared animals were just flat-out unknowns. And then another, you know, 25% we thought were perhaps related to disease or starvation, but really just didn't have the data. Another significant portion of the mortality identified in northwestern Minnesota was related to liver flukes and liver fluke infection. So there are a number of factors we were looking at, but really we didn't have good information or, you know, good final results coming out of that study to tell us what was happening in the Northwest. So that population in early 2000s really declined considerably, and we started looking at our northeastern population, trying to think, you know, this was a population we thought was fairly stable and in good shape, and we thought we needed to invest some energy into looking at, you know, the mortality factors in that population and see what was going on over there. And again, similar effects of, you know, the technology, the ability to get in and find out what's going on with moose in that area. 33% of the mortalities were just unknown, and 31% were unknown or health-related. We were suspected health conditions, perhaps disease. Of the natural mortality, wolves were found to be 9% of the mortality, and we also had a small percentage bacterial meningitis. But you can see there are a number of factors that were impacting moose in the Northeast when we looked at that study. Our researchers also looked at the relationship of survival with seasonal temperatures. Moose are a boreal species and, you know, cold weather adapted. And so they're looking to see if that had any influence on their survival rates. And basically they found an interesting correlation between winter temperatures and subsequent survival in the spring, in the fall, the annual survival, and also that the next winter's survival. So while that we didn't have a causal relationship, it was kind of an interesting, we're wondering if temperatures are having some sort of influence on moose. So kind of getting to the information we have today about our moose population trends, I want to just cover briefly our survey techniques that we use to track and monitor the population. Up on the slide is basically our moose range that we have stratified into plots that are low density, medium density, and high density, and we conduct aerial surveys. And in Minnesota, we're quite fortunate. We've got fairly long-term data. We've been doing moose surveys since the 60s, and we've changed our techniques over time, so we can't compare every year going forward because some of the techniques have changed. But since 2005, our surveys, our protocol has been pretty well standardized, and we've got a good data set going back to 2005. But, you know, when you look across populations around the country or around the continent, you know, we're pretty fortunate in terms of the amount of information we have on moose populations. So in 2014, we just finished our aerial moose survey. We actually surveyed 52 plots out there. And I forgot to mention, I'm going to go back real quickly. One of the new things that we're also doing is we have some permanent habitat plots. They're depicted in orange. It's probably tough to see. But those plots were put in place on our survey to actually track forest disturbance and how that influenced moose density. So we're taking advantage of some of the recent fires and blowdowns and kind of taking a look at what impacts that may have on moose density. So that was incorporated into our survey design. Okay, so we surveyed 52 plots in 2014. What have we... real quickly, give you a sense of what that looks like. We use helicopters, and we fly about 100 meters over the ground, so not very high, pretty low down, get good visual observations. We're flying fairly slowly at about 75 kilometers to 100 kilometers per hour. And in the helicopter, we have a pilot and two observers that are there recording the data on a computer that actually can track the travel of the helicopter, and they can track it over aerial imagery. So we've got real good location data from our surveys. Another point about the consistency in terms of our survey data that's really valuable, both pilots and all but one observer that participate in these surveys have been doing it for over 10 years. So we've got a real assurance that from year to year, you know, the data are being collected in a very similar manner, and that's a real benefit. So what are we finding? This is the chart of our population estimates from 2005 to 2014. And, you know, it's been worrisome. We've been watching it, the population decline, but only until recently were we able to actually, with statistical significance, demonstrate that this is a true population decline. You know, we saw the trend, but, you know, the confidence intervals were overlapping to such an extent that it's just recently that we're able to say that with some confidence. This year, our point estimate was up. It was up to 43.50, and that's up, you know, considerably over the last year's point estimate. But you can see their confidence intervals overlap. So, we're still seeing this long-term decline in the population in terms of that trend line. And I just to point that out a little bit, you know, the real value of this survey data is the multi-year information and the context that provides. We can kind of look at pick any of those points on those charts and try and make an assumption about what's going on with the population. But being able to look at that trend line over time is really valuable. And the chart on the upper left, I have the estimates from 2005 through 2014, so including that higher estimate we recently had and the trend line that we get from those estimates. And then I also compared that to basically the same information reported last year without that high estimate. And you can see that even with that higher estimate, our trend line barely changes. What we're seeing is an 18% on average decline from year to year in terms of our population. So what are we doing about that now? We've got considerable research going on, and it's exciting in terms of the number of agencies and research projects that are going on. It's a large collaborative study. We're looking into a number of factors. So numerous research projects are looking at the adult and the calf mortality related to a whole suite of factors, looking at nutrition and habitat quality and sort of habitat use related to forest manipulations or forest management. Some studies are looking at white-tailed deer and moose interactions in terms of the potential risk of disease transmission. Thermoregulation, as I mentioned, they're a cold-adapted species, so what are moose doing potentially related to their behavioral activities or habitats that are used? Or, you know, how does thermoregulation relate to the suite of factors? Wolf-moose interactions, looking at the level of predation on moose and a number of other factors associated with that. And that's just a start to some of the projects. It's really an impressive suite of efforts that are going on. And this is of interest not even just in Minnesota or across the country, but the research that's going on here in Minnesota and supported by the state has gotten interest globally. It's pretty exciting. In terms of management, we continue to do these annual aerial moose surveys to track the population and monitor them. And we also have developed a moose management and research plan. And along with that comes we develop biennial work plans or implementation plans and are, you know, really ramping up our communication on what management activities and research findings we have. In 2013, we canceled the state's annual moose harvest until further notice, and Fond du Lac Indian Band and the 1854 Treaty Authority also canceled their moose harvest in 2013. Last August, the moose was officially listed as by the state as a species of special concern. And because of the high level of interest, the various research that's going on, and land managers want to know what they can do for moose, we have an annual research and moose management meeting to share the most up-to-date information we have. We've also done a moose habitat inventory and, are looking at, have developed a habitat suitability index to try and inform some of the research, but also some of the management activities are there. Where can we maybe target some of our habitat enhancements? So we've actually got ongoing habitat projects as well. I think that's where I'm going to stop. I do want to acknowledge that this is a multi-agency collaborative effort in terms of research and management, and this is not all-inclusive, but certainly there are a lot of folks out there that are helping to provide additional information on moose in Minnesota. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. McNally. Are there any questions from the subcommittee? If not, I'd just like to ask one. Now, what do we know of the populations north of the border? Is this simply a matter of migration of the moose population, or is it an overall decline in North America?
It's really varied, and actually recently Ron Moen, a researcher up at the University of Minnesota Duluth, has a nice overview that he's provided that kind of shows populations are following different trajectories in different areas. Along the Canadian border, you do see a lot of declines. But it's patchy, and so there aren't real clear trends in relation to why that's happening But I would suggest, you know, that would be a good information we could provide to you in terms of his overview of, you know, the different research efforts and what's going on in terms of continental moose.
Sure. But and thank you. That's helpful. But certainly we're finding carcasses. There's a kill-off, so to speak. We don't know why that's happening, and that's really a problem we're trying to put our finger on with the existing research that's out there now.
Yes.
Okay. And then just for the benefit of the subcommittee, could you just tell us what is meant by a species of special concern? What are the ramifications? What does that mean? What sort of activity does that trigger?
When a species is listed as a species of special concern, it gets placed on that list along with endangered and threatened species in Minnesota. However, species of special concern don't have the same sort of restrictions over them. For example, it doesn't automatically require harvest to be ceased or hunting season to be ceased. It just means that we are paying additional attention and additional monitoring is required in terms of those species. And certainly with moose, they're getting additional monitoring.
Very good. Any other questions from members of the subcommittee? Well, otherwise, if you don't mind following up to the subcommittee with that information, the broader population trends elsewhere, just so we get a picture of the bigger context here, that'd be helpful for us. Otherwise, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Nice overview. Thank you.
All right. Up next, we have a similar presentation on the Minnesota invasive carp population and what's happening there. And if we could, testifiers, come to the table. And if you don't mind stating your name for the record, please, sir.
Nick Frohnauer, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources,
Division
of Ecological and Water Resources, Invasive Fish Coordinator.
Great. Well, thank you, sir. Welcome to the subcommittee.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for giving me the opportunity to update you on the DNR's actions and activities related to Asian carp. The DNR actively monitors for Asian carp expansion into Minnesota using a variety of methods, including monitoring the commercial harvest, contracting commercial fishermen to target Asian carp in Minnesota waters.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. I want to get this on the table. I take offense to the word Asian carp, and I talk to Peter Sorensen about what the name is, and you know, I jokingly said, well, it was us who brought the invasive carp over here, so maybe it should be called Caucasian carp. And he said the fix is big headed, and the silver is a big head carp, and the big head is a big headed carp. So I just as we're sitting here, I just wanted to lay that out there that I would like us to come up with a better terminology of the invasive carp that we're talking about without plugging it. And I know they come from Asia, but I happen to represent the second largest Hmong community in the state of Minnesota, and there's some sensitivity to that word, and I just wanted to let you know that.
So. Okay, thank you. So noted. I'll refer to them as invasive carps from here on out.
That sounds good. Thank you, Sir Hoffman, and please proceed, Mr. Fraunhauer.
Additionally, the DNR uses their traditional fishery sampling and targeted invasive carps sampling, and lastly, we also rely on the public to report any potential sightings, whether they are in jumping or they catch them. So for 2013, there were 10 carps reported to the DNR. This is a slight increase from 9 in the previous year of 2012. Individuals were captured from Pool 7, which is located by La Crosse, all the way up to Sartell, Minnesota. But note the one from Sartell is probably an escapee from stocking in a local pond rather than getting up there by its own swimming ability. To date, there's been no documented reproduction or spawning in Minnesota waters.
Sure.
Along those lines, we are doing environmental DNA sampling in conjunction with the University of Minnesota's Aquatic Invasives Research Center. They are the project lead, and the most recent analysis show little evidence of big head and silver carp in Minnesota waters, though as indicated in the captures, there are obviously some individuals in the waters. It's understood that the best way to limit the impacts of invasive species is to prevent them from becoming established in the first place. And one of the highest risk pathways for Asian carp into Minnesota is by their natural swimming ability. So we have looked into and are pursuing different projects of preventing them from getting in with the barriers, of which the legislature funded the Coon Rapids Dam. Though maybe not a 100% perfect solution, it did provide an area to slow or deter their movement into the upper Mississippi. That is a two-phase project, with half of it having been completed here in 2013, and it's still on schedule, and with the rest of the project completed in 2014. Along those lines, we have explored more effective solutions downstream, and in this I'm referring to the upper St. Anthony Falls lock and lock and dam 1. The DNR supports and recognizes that closure of the upper St. Anthony Falls is probably the most effective solution, biologically speaking, against Asian carp, but lock closure requires federal legislation. There are provisions in both the Senate version and the House versions of the Water Resources Development Act to close the upper St. Anthony Falls. That is currently in conference committee. The actual closure of the lock is not a point of contention, but it is tied up in conference committee based on other non-related issues. Just give a little background. A year ago, we understood that it would require federal legislation, but at that time it was very uncertain. We didn't know how that would progress at the federal level, especially since this lock and dam has never been closed before or authorized for closure before. So we started down the path of our alternative solution by looking at a barrier solution at Lock and Dam 1. And this is the electrical barrier that you may be familiar with being discussed in papers. We contracted with the Smith Root Incorporation to design a barrier with their new technology. We executed the contract in the beginning of May, and we are currently on schedule with that, with hopefully a 100% completed design submitted to the DNR in late May or early June. If we were to continue down this path for construction, it could potentially happen in late 2014. With that being said, if WERDA passes, we would not continue on with the construction of this barrier. But at this time, we would continue with the completion of the design. First of all, we've spent pretty much all the money allocated to it. And second of all, a complete design would give us a better understanding of the cost, potential effectiveness, safety concerns associated with this technology in case we wanted to apply it somewhere else on the landscape. We haven't forgotten about the Minnesota River. While a lot of attention and focus has been on the Mississippi, the DNR has put forth effort on the Minnesota River. Unfortunately, it's a more complex system without maybe as readily available solution. But we are working with the University of Minnesota's Research Center, and what we believe is probably the best alternative right now in looking at lock and dams 8, 5, and 2 and seeing if there are operational procedures and lock chamber deterrent technologies that can slow or deter their movement up the river and eventually into the Minnesota River. We are also working in conjunction with USGS and Minnesota Water Resources Center to look at to do a floodplain analysis to try to get a better grip of the size and the parameters that we're dealing with in the Minnesota River and looking down there and seeing applying those to potentially a barrier solution or why a barrier solution may not be the best fit for that. In the meantime, the Fisheries Division is installing barriers and shoring up watershed breaches to prevent invasive carps from entering, as we like to call, through the back door, which is the Missouri River. They've made their way up. They're well-established in the Missouri River, and they have made their way up into Iowa, into the Iowa Great Lakes, which is right on the southern border of Minnesota and with Iowa. We provided them with funding to help offset costs to put a deterrent barrier in to prevent additional Asian carp from getting into the lakes there. We also have six other projects that are looking at the watershed breaches, meaning that if they can get upstream from jumping during high water from that watershed into the other and getting into the Minnesota River. Two of those projects are completed, and four others are in various stages. And then just a couple other notes. The state, or there is a Minnesota Asian Carp Action Plan, which was published in 2011. You can find it on the Minnesota DNR website if you haven't read it already. It's a fairly young plan, but there has been a lot of information and data gained since that time. So we have engaged with our partner agencies and our stakeholders to update and revise that action plan, and that is currently ongoing. And then I'd like to end it up by mentioning that there will be an Asian Carp Forum, which will be a presentation by a variety of agencies just giving updates on progress and lessons learned and that type of thing in relation to invasive carps. And that is scheduled for March 13th from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock at the Minnesota Valley National Wildlife Refuge Auditorium for those who are interested in attending. Right. With that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Perfect.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Fronhauer. Appreciate your testimony here. Members of the subcommittee, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, I serve on the LCCMR, and it was really amazing to see some of the work that is being done at not only at the University of Minnesota here on our Twin Cities campus, but also the researcher at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. He's able to move the invasive carp and with the sonar, and I was blown away at just the technology that's there and available. And especially, there was a picture going around that showed the silver had landed on top of the Winona Dam, and you know, another 2 feet, and that little guy would have been swimming upstream toward Lock and Dam number what, 8 or 5, whatever the next one is in line there. But we've kind of upped the ante to Peter Sorensen and those folks to, you know, get us some work done, because they're thinking it's just a matter of short time before we see this reality. So with that in mind, are you working hard and collaboratively with both the researcher at the University of Minnesota Duluth, who's able to, and we actually watched him move this fish, you know, in the Illinois River, and also with Dr. Sorensen at the University of Minnesota. Can you kind of give us an update on those two people?
Mr. Chair, Senators.
Mr. Fronhauer.
We work real closely with the Minnesota Aquatic Research Center at the U of M. Not so much with UMD, but the assumption there is that that you know, those institutions are in contact with each other. But I meet or talk to them at least weekly about issues and how we can help each other out. Them with their expertise, us with our manpower that we can potentially supply to them.
That's good to hear.
Any other questions out of the gates? If you could, sir, you know, I'm from southeastern Minnesota, and there's a great deal of recreational and boating opportunities along the Mississippi River. Lake Pepin, any weekend day or weekday in the summertime, is full of boats, many sailboats and others. And I'm just curious, you know, if you could focus in on that area, that would likely be the greatest immediate threat of any species moving upriver. If you could talk a little bit about efforts underway down there and what you see, and obviously, Senator Hoffman made reference to the carcass found on Lock and Dam this summer or early this fall. It was cause for great concern. Could you speak to those issues a little bit more?
Mr. Chair, yeah. At this time, I call the captures that we have isolated catches. Most of them are individuals. Once in a while, you get a couple caught in a net. So while the threat's immediate, we do have a lot of concern. They aren't there yet. Unfortunately, with the Mississippi River, it's a complex system. A year ago, maybe not as optimistic of slowing them into that portion just based on the pure size of the river, but in talking with Dr. Sorensen's group and his project with 2, 5, and 8, I think there is definitely more optimism now that we can at least slow them up into this area. That should allow researchers time to help our control strategies catch up, whether that be commercial fishing or the bio-bullet that you hear that USGS is working on or some other type of management control.
Sure. Well, thank you for that. And if you could speak to I think you mentioned an issue of a carcass being found in northern Minnesota. To what extent do we see imports of these fish, or what kind of control mechanisms are in place there?
Mr. Chair, the invasive carps are illegal to transport in the state of Minnesota. So,
do you have any sense as to what extent this is still a problem, despite the fact that that is illegal?
I can't answer that. I don't have a grip on that.
Sure.
I'd have to go back and look at the fish. I think it was fairly old, so it very well could have been a fish brought in before anybody understood what they were doing or knew that it was illegal or the impacts that this type of fish could have.
Sure. And I understand that some of these may be isolated cases. So nonetheless, great sensitivity out there, and particularly down in my neck of the woods, just with the threat to recreational activities and tourism and such. So any other additional questions from members of the subcommittee? Well, thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators.
Next, if we could have another population update from DNR regarding the deer population. Welcome back, Ms. McNally.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
And if you could, for the record, state your name and proceed.
Leslie McInerney, Big Game Program Leader, Minnesota DNR. And I'll be talking about deer population management here in Minnesota. Briefly, we manage deer populations here in Minnesota based on population goals. And the last time goals were established statewide was between the years 2005 and 2007. And those goals were established through a public process in which we used advisory teams along with public comment to provide recommendations on deer population goals and their desires by permit area. The map that I've got on this slide here depicts our various permit areas, the units that we manage, within which we manage deer. And the map depicts the outcomes of the process from 2005 to 2007. So what you see in front of you is in the northern forest area and forest transition zones, there's a lot of permit areas that are red or orange, and that indicates that public process established goals to reduce the deer population in those areas. Red is by about 25%, orange is about 10% or a slight reduction. Conversely, in the farmland regions where we have fewer deer and densities are lower, there was interest in increasing the deer populations. The dark green is a 25% increase, light green is a 10%. And so there are a smattering of yellow permit areas where folks just wanted to maintain the population basically at a stable level that they observed between those years. And those goals are set for a multi-year effort. Basically, what we can do then is on an annual basis when we set our management strategies and make management decisions, they're based on those goals and how well we're moving our population toward those goals. The way that we manage deer populations is through hunter harvest. And on this slide, I've placed our harvest strategies for 2013. It's got all of our permit areas and basically depicts some of the tools that we use to manage deer numbers. And the colors relate to basically bag limits in a permit area, how many deer an individual hunter can harvest on their license. We can be very conservative. For example, at one end of the scale, we can use a lottery strategy where there's a one deer limit and folks actually have to apply through a lottery to be able to harvest an antlerless deer. And then on the other end of the scale, we have strategies that allow us to take multiple antlerless deer in a managed unit, which is red on this map. That's a two deer limit. In intensive areas, which are green, that's a five deer limit. And we focus our management, our harvest pressure on antlerless deer because they represent the reproductive potential for the following year. And so that's why as we're trying to manage populations or control populations, we increase pressure on antlerless deer in areas where we want to either maintain population or limit population growth or even bring populations down. And so, for example, you know, we're more likely to use those more conservative approaches, one deer limits, in areas where we're looking for population increases in general. And on the other end of the scale, we use these more liberal strategies to put pressure on the population and either stabilize it or reduce it. And one important thing to note about these strategies that we use is that, you know, the same strategy, depending on where it's used, can have a very different outcome. For example, Permit Area 117 is up in the Boundary Waters area, and last year we used a hunter's choice strategy. That's a one deer. You can harvest either a male or a female deer. So we used that strategy up in 117. We used the same strategy down in the Whitewater, you know, down in 344. And those areas have very different habitats, different habitat qualities, different densities, you know, different hunting pressure. And so, for example, if we think that 117 is at goal, a hunter's choice strategy, because of the hunting pressure and the reproductive capability of that habitat, might be fine just to keep a stable population. Whereas you use that same strategy down in the southeast, and it may lead to population growth just because of the productive capability of an area. So, you know, in terms of these colors, you can't necessarily think that if the whole state were, you know, at goal or where we wanted it to be, we would be using the same strategy. We've got quite a bit of flexibility with these different strategies to work and move the population in the direction we'd like to see. These aren't all of the strategies. You know, for example, in severe cases, you know, potentially even this year, we could go to a bucks-only strategy in some of the areas, and I'll get into that a little bit. So we've got these population goals that were established, you know, between 2005 and 2007, and we've got these different strategies we use. And I wanted to kind of depict how we've used those strategies over time to move our populations in the direction, you know, we're working towards. So the graph on top is from 2005 through 2013, depicts the management strategies we've used and how they've used over time. Basically, the percentages, you know, what percent of our permit areas are under that management strategy. And you can see early on when our populations in the mid-2000s were higher than what we had decided they ought to be at a statewide level, we were using more liberal or more aggressive harvest strategies to try and bring those populations down. More areas had harvest strategies where you could harvest more than one deer in a permit area. So that's that green and that blue. And as we move our populations toward goal and we decrease the population a bit, we've been able to become more conservative over time with our harvest strategies. So now we have very few areas where we're harvesting more than one deer in a permit area. So the maps on the bottom show from 2005, you can see the spread of our management strategies. On the right, that's the 2013 map. We've become considerably more conservative in our management over these past years. And how that relates to our deer harvest, I've got a graph up here from 1994 to 2013, our total deer harvest. And it's broken out by different seasons that we have, firearms, archery, and muzzleloader. But it's, you know, you can look at the cumulative bars. And you can notice that, you know, in those mid-2000s, and we were getting extremely high harvests. And that was related to, one, higher populations, but two, those aggressive strategies where we were harvesting multiple deer in permit areas per hunter. And you can see how the harvest, along with the populations coming closer to goal and our more constricted harvest, our harvest strategies, we've decreased harvest over time as well. So that's kind of the trend and the pattern that we're seeing related to those two factors. If you look in terms of the long term and look at annual harvest by decade, this decade, you know, we've only got a few years, but we're still considerably higher than any harvest we saw prior to 1990. So, you know, what we've seen and experienced in recent years really stands out as different from, you know, the kind of the long-term deer harvest in Minnesota. And you can see that 2000 through 2009 you know, really was a kind of a blip in terms of high levels of harvest. And part of what I think we're hearing from folks is, you know, they've experienced that higher harvest, and it's kind of a surprise to go back to what is, you know, maybe more normal after that intensive harvest. But all along, it was intentional to bring populations down and have higher harvest that we knew wouldn't necessarily be sustainable in the long term. So given that, given the fact that we've been fairly successful in meeting those population goals or moving populations toward goal, we've started revisiting population goals around the state. And this map here depicts we started in 2012. In gray is our areas that were revisited in 2012. And we took sort of a little bit of a hiatus. We did an evaluation of our public engagement process and how we have public participate in decision-making and have some recommendations coming out of that evaluation that we wanted to test out, and we thought the goal-setting process would be a good means to test those recommendations. So in 2014, we're only doing one of these goal-setting blocks. That's the orange down in the southeast. And based on our experience with the process this year, you know, we might make some revisions and then roll it out on a bigger scale in 2015 and 2016. Now, population goals that we revisit this year in 2014, we will have goals set so that we can implement strategies this fall. So anything in 2015 that is revisited, we plan to be implementing strategies by fall of 2015. So we do plan to, you know, roll these out and get them in place and act on them fairly quickly. In terms of the process, it's very similar to the process we used last year, but we are putting extra effort into getting additional public information and background information on the front end. You know, we've always collected harvest stats and population stats and factors that are important in terms of deer population goal setting. But this time around, we're also putting emphasis on collecting data that are representative of sort of what the public at large think about deer populations in their area and their desires. So we've got statistically designed male surveys that have gone out to hunters and landowners. And, you know, one of the reasons behind that is we hope to, you know, give folks a better sense that we've got wider background in terms of what the public really wants. It's not just, you know, these 20 folks that were selected. They were selected because they represent diverse interests, but, you know, it's more than just those 20 voices around the table that are influencing population goals. So we've got a lot of effort going into background information. We're also doing public input, meetings, and questionnaires at the front end. Last time around, we basically asked for public comment after those recommendations were developed. So hopefully we're keeping the public informed of the process and giving them opportunities to weigh in. Right now, this goal-setting process shows what's going on in the Southeast. This March, our advisory team will be meeting. We've got 21 members on that team, and they are expected to develop recommendations for population goals. And those recommendations will be put out for public comment, and the department will then finalize those recommendations in order to implement harvest strategies this year. So in terms of, you know, I know that there are a lot of folks that are a bit, you know, anxious. They see this winter's certainly tough on deer in some places and severe in some places, and there's an anxiety that we're only focusing. There's a lot of energy going into the Southeast, but the way that we manage deer with our annual harvest strategies gives us an opportunity to kind of check in with goals and address, you know, year-to-year conditions that might not otherwise be addressed. And so we are actually holding listening sessions this year collaboration with the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and we'll be providing some background information on how we make our management decisions around the state, and give folks an idea on how we might be responding to the winter conditions and what we're hearing from folks. It doesn't mean that we're shifting away from those goals that were set through that process, but it lets folks know that we have an opportunity on a year-to-year basis to evaluate conditions and address them. And so it's not just driving, you know, blindly forth with a population goal. So we're looking forward to sharing that information with folks and also, you know, bringing that into it. We do a season setting meeting among staff to set our harvest strategies, and that information will inform the discussion at that time. So this map I have up here is our winter severity index, and basically it shows that, you know, the northeastern Minnesota we anticipate it's going to be a real severe winter for deer, and that'll influence or increase over winter mortality. And with that, I'd like to open it up for questions.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. McAnally. If we could have some questions from the subcommittee, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I heard that the DNR is feeding deer up north. Is that accurate?
Senator Eaton, that is, and I may not accurately explain it, but basically we have a fund that a portion of hunting license dollars has gone into to support emergency deer feeding as well as cervid health management. And there was a request to use some of those funds to conduct emergency deer feeding in northeastern Minnesota.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, if I could, Ms. McNeil, if you could just comment about a little bit more about the severity of this winter and what you expect to come of it. I've heard from a lot of deer hunters over the course of the last several months about just a concern with population declines with this past hunting season. And I understand your points that, you know, in terms of the historical context with those populations. But if you could just say a little bit more about this winter and where it ranks in a historical perspective and what sorts of things you might do moving forward. If it's premature, I understand, but I'd just like to get a little bit more detail from you.
Hey, Mr. Chair, sure. I'll go back to that winter severity map. This year's winter severity is quite a bit higher than the winter severity of an average winter. We had the most recent severe winter conditions that we had here in Minnesota really were the 1995-96 and 96-97 winter years, where we experienced in the first year fairly significant mortality of our deer population. In one of our study areas, we saw 30% over winter mortality of deer. And that was in that first year. The interesting thing that we found with our long-term research was by the following year, which was basically, you know, similar severe conditions, the overwinter mortality was only 8%. And so, you know, this year, it's not exactly a perfect comparison, but last winter was a bit tough as well. The winter just went on and on into May. You know, we had snow problems up north, and so it was a tougher winter last winter as well. And now we've got this winter too. So, you know, from our experience in 95, 96, 96, 97, we know that, you know, you have to factor in kind of the winters before and the winters after it. So it's more than just looking at one year's winter severity. But we also found, you know, that after those harsh winters, within 3 years, our deer population was back to the pre-severe winter conditions. So deer are very resilient. You know, we will see a population impact, but they do rebound. And we also, the following year, so I think it was within 4 years, our harvest was just as high as it was pre-severe winter conditions. So we're hopeful. We know we've got the management tools to address it, and we'll likely see much more conservative management strategies, particularly in those northern areas.
Very well. Thank you. And if I could follow up, I hear a lot from folks who, in some cases, there aren't enough deer to hunt. And in other cases, if you have a cornfield, there are too many deer in a given proximity. And if you're able to just speak a little bit to what DNR does to combat those challenges, in this case, too many deer in a given area.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we do have to address multiple interests and perspectives in deer population management, and it can be tough. You know, I've been working on the deer population goal setting in the Southeast, and there are higher densities in the Southeast than in much of the state, and so we do have conflicts with farmers and other landowners as conflicting with hunter interests. And, you know, what we try and do is, you know, find a way that we can kind of meet in the middle. But certainly we also need to use additional strategies. We have a depredation program within the department that can help work with farmers that are experiencing crop depredation and have various tools that they can use to try and address, you know, localized issues that can't be addressed through population management. So it's kind of a give and take. Trying to bring both perspectives into the discussion is the first part, and then it's, you know, one trying to find that middle ground. You know, it usually is not a perfect middle ground. It goes back and forth a little bit, but it's also finding other tools that we can work together and address those more local scale issues.
Very well. Well, thank you. If there aren't any other questions from the subcommittee, I want to thank you for your overview today. That's very helpful and gives us a good basis for future considerations here in the committee. So thank you.
Thank you.
And up next, we have we're finished with the updates and the overviews. But if we could we could talk about Senate File 2227, the DNR's Game and Fish technical bill. If you could just walk us through the bill here today. We're not planning on taking any votes or any amendments marking it up, but we would like to take this opportunity to have a brief overview. So,
Mr. Chair, members, Bob Meyer. The DNR, really quickly, I'm not sure if you wanted to have a brief AIS update before we did that bill or not. I do have staff in the room that could provide that for the committee if they're interested.
Mr. Meyer, if you do, let's take the opportunity to have that overview.
Thank you. Just be a few minutes. Thank you.
Well, welcome to the subcommittee. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ann Pierce, and I'm the DNR's section manager for the section that oversees the invasive species program.
Right.
And so today I thought I would just give you a brief update about where we are going in the next year. We have been working, recognizing how important our partners are, and that we have a large group of Minnesotans who are really deeply involved in the AIS issue and have a strong desire to have an effect on the program direction that we have. So one of the big directions we're going to be going is really, we already have partners, we really want to work on building those. And to enhance these partnerships in 2013, we developed a AIS advisory committee. And this advisory committee is a group of 15 committee members plus four ex officio who are really our key partners from a federal standpoint, an education standpoint, and other agency standpoint. These 15 members represent a broad range of personal and professional experiences, and they bring that to the discussion around the prevention efforts for invasive species. And some of the issues that they've been working on include things like helping us really effectively distribute our watercraft inspectors across the state with the resources that we have, education about public awareness at access sites, AIS communication plan, and lake service provider training, which was developed in 2012. They're also working with us to help us revise our AIS education program, which is our volunteer program that a lot of our local partners use to make it more effective for that group of local partners. We're also continuing to expand our partnerships with local units of government and tribal governments through delegation agreements. So these delegation agreements allow the local units of government and tribal governments to have the same authority that the DNR has to do inspections. We've increased those agreements from 18 in 2012. We did 25 last year. That got 293 more inspectors on the ground, and it added 64,000 inspections to the DNR's 123,000 inspections. So we're trying to really manage and work on this partnership scale to really distribute this prevention effort across the state. We also have a small grant program to help those local units of government support those programs. The other aspect that we're really looking into this year is the research component of invasive species. And we're working in a close partnership with the University of Minnesota's Aquatic Invasive Species Center. We're working on the invasive carp issues with Peter Sorensen, risk assessments with some of the staff that they have there, and invasive aquatic plant management, along with their new zebra mussel research expert, Mike McCartney. We're working with him quite cooperatively on determining the priorities for Minnesota and what kind of work he can do to help us better understand how to prevent the spread of these species. We are also on our own, as part of the department work, in conjunction with our inspectors, we're looking at the risk of residual water and water-related equipment. What really is that risk of transport for things like zebra mussel veligers? And then probably one of our most important components this year is we are starting out embarking on a series of risk assessments that are related to various water-related activities. And our first risk assessment is going to be associated with bait harvest from both a private and commercial standpoint. We're going to be looking at the risk associated with all the activities involved in bait harvest. And one of the reasons we chose this as our first activity is there have been a number of bills brought forward looking at altering some of the current conditions that are in place for bait harvest. And we thought instead of doing this at a piecemeal basis, request by request, we really need to look at this as a whole and figure out if we tweak one side of it, what are the risks with that and how does it impact other aspects of this. So that's a big component that we're going to lead into right away at the beginning of this year. The other piece, I just wanted to let this committee know that we have now, since 2014, we have now trained over 1,000 service providers. Those are all up on our website so people can find access to people who have been trained in the prevention of spread of AIS through activities like removing docks and boat lifts. We've improved that programs to make it much more effective with the people we're training. We have an educator on board who's produced better materials, hands-on training, and online guidance for people. That's been really helpful for us. And then probably the last piece that I just wanted to mention, which is a key piece of what we're doing right now, is we have a good prevention program in place with the resources that we have. And our current program gives us a good base to address new species that are on the horizon and to give us some time so that the research that is needed can help us with the management and control of what's already here. But we also need to really get the message out that to prevent the spread of AIS really takes personal responsibility. At this point, we still have approximately 20% violation rate, and our goal is zero. We want a zero violation rate. We want that because people understand what actions they take and what the risks of those actions are. They understand how to prevent the spread, and they understand the impact that these species have on our lake systems, and they care about preventing the spread. So we have started a new campaign, which is Think Zero, and if you have the fishing regulations, we have a new kind of ad on the back of it that talks about what it takes to protect our lakes, and that our goal is to make sure that everyone understands what they need to do and how to do that activity. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Pierce. Any questions? Otherwise, that was very instructive. We appreciate that overview, and we may have some questions for you down the road, but this was great for today.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your work. With that said, if we might move into the next item on our agenda is Senate File 2227. We'll just like to take the opportunity to have an overview of that. Again, we're not moving on the bill, not hearing amendments today. We'll be doing that next Tuesday, but did want to have an opportunity to run through the bill here today. So thank you. If you could state your name for the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. Good afternoon. I'm Ed Bogus. I'm director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. And I'll try to work through Senate File 2227, but also point out I think you've got a fact sheet that kind of cross-references some of these provisions are found in multiple sections of the bill. So just to quickly walk through the bill, I would just preface this by saying that there's not a lot of momentous new policy proposed in this bill. It's the focus this year for us is on obsolete, outdated, redundant type language, technical corrections. There are a few more significant policy sections in here that I'll point out as I come to them, but you'll see most of the bill is just trying to clean up some obsolete or redundant type language or make technical corrections. So the first section, the first three sections of the bill relate to the Black Apparel Wildlife Management Area. This is out western Minnesota near the South Dakota border. This area was formed back in, I don't know when exactly, the 30s or whatever. And involved transfer of authority from the federal government, and there's a lot of obsolete language here that relates to old old acts from the 30s and some kind of just policy language or just sort of background language with no policy effect, talking about why things should be done with the onset of the current war, which was World War II and things like that. So we're just trying to clean up some of those statutes, as you know, the governor is certainly working with all the agencies to do. So that's the first three sections. Section 4 and 5 relate to just trying to make the snowmobile restrictions during the deer hunting season consistent with the ATV restrictions during the deer hunting season. So we're changing some things that are currently in rule and just putting them into statute to make that consistent. Section 6 just deletes a reference to a section of statute related to Muskie Lake designations that I'll talk about later that we're proposing to repeal. Section 7, 8 both relate to the Red Lake Wildlife Management Area, which is up in northwestern Minnesota. A lot of this land was attempted to be drained and farmed, and it didn't work. It was bog and peatland, and so eventually there was relocation of settlers, and a lot of that area became a large wildlife management area. There's a lot of federal land utilization project land and other land in that area. So this is just cleaning up a little bit of the statutes about some of the accounting and references to laws related to Red Lake. Section 9 relates to just the technical correction where it's talking about acquiring property rights in wild animals, but it's referencing wild rice statutes, so that's just a technical cleanup. Section 10. For the Game and Fish Oversight Committees, I know there's a lot of interest this year in getting rid of outdated advisory committees and councils and things like that. And the department has a Game and Fish Fund Oversight Committee that we don't consider to be an advisory council. So we have some language the beginning on line 5.28 that just makes it clear that this citizen oversight committee that reviews the Game and Fish Fund expenditures is not an advisory council or committee and is not subject to those statutes. And then it also clarifies, we've offered them mileage since this committee was formed in the 90s, but this just makes it clear for this committee that we can continue to do that, but that they do not receive any daily compensation. We usually buy them sandwiches and give them some mileage. So Section 11 just deletes game farm, the commissioner's authority to acquire property for game farms. We closed our last game farm in the 1970s. So Section 12 relates to the types of motorized vehicle use that we can authorize by permit for people with disabilities on wildlife areas, which are typically non-motorized. Currently, it allows snowmobile or ATV. We would be adding highway license vehicle or motorboat permits for people with disabilities. Section 13 relates to permits to cross state lands within wildlife management areas to give the commissioner clear authority to allow temporary right-of-way access for resource management purposes. And then B is to permit a private landowner or leaseholder to cross state lands by motorized vehicle for access to their applicant's land when that's the only reasonable access. Section 14 and 15 relate to refunds and corrections for issuance of licenses through the electronic licensing system. We give the commissioner authority to issue a refund if the license was issued incorrectly, if there's evidence it was issued incorrectly. And then the companion to that is Section 15, which adds a subdivision 6 that gives the commissioner authority to correct a license or type if it was issued incorrectly and if we're notified in a timely manner within 30 days and the season for that license has not started at the time of the request, and further that the licensee is entitled to that corrected license, then we can give them the correct license, refund the difference if it was an overcharge, or charge the difference if it was an undercharge for what they originally received. Section 16, and then there's going to be a number of sections later on that are listed in the fact sheet relate to we're proposing to consolidate a lot of the commissioner's authorities around small game, and the language being stricken in Section 16 is just a section that would be eliminated later in the bill with that consolidation of just putting all the authorities for small game into one section. Right now there's authorities in multiple sections for game birds, various mammals, and so forth. So that's just trying to eliminate some redundancy and streamline small game authorities. Section 17 to 20 adjusts some lifetime license fees, mostly related to spearing licenses that contain a spearing option. There were some changes. We did a hunting and fishing fee bill a couple years ago, and some of the fees were changing kind of last minute as we were going through conference committee and so forth, and we didn't get all the lifetime fees adjusted appropriately, and there was at least one error in a fee in the sporting licenses. So this is these three sections, 18, 19, and 20, are just correcting those lifetime license fees. And then you'll see later in the bill, we have sold some of these licenses at a higher fee than what they should have been. And so we were seeking the authority to refund people that purchased those licenses the difference if they overpaid in the since March of last year when these fees took effect.
If you could, Mr. Bogus, is that just a technical mistake, or what had happened there? Why was the overcharging?
Well, the overcharging was because at the time the fees were increased, Mr. Chair, 2 years ago, you know, there was kind of a last-minute change to the proposal for the spearing license. And the spearing license, there's a lifetime spearing license. There's an angling with spearing. Mm-hmm. There's a sports with spearing. So all of those didn't get adjusted kind of in the last-minute flurry of putting the bill together. Meanwhile, that bill became law, and those licenses took effect March 1 of 2013. It passed in 2012 with an effective date of March 1 of 2013. And We didn't really become aware of it in time to get it fixed last year, so we've been selling. Those licenses went on sale last year. People were buying them. We became aware, I don't remember exactly when, later on in the spring or summer, that we had these errors in the fees. We were essentially overcharging people from what they should be based on the new fee for the regular annual licenses. These are all based off the annual license fees. So because some people have purchased those licenses, we think it's only fair to go back and offer them that refund.
Fair enough. Thank you. Yep, please proceed.
Okay, Section 21 and 22 relate to 21 is for residents, 22 is for non-residents. There was another error that we didn't catch on for people under age 18 to take bears. Previously, there had been no fee for residents under age 18 to take bear, and then all the other youth licenses, there was also a change kind of in those last minutes of those fees for the department had proposed half-price youth licenses. The final decision from the legislature was $5 for youth licenses, so that didn't all get fixed for bears, for youth bear licenses. So this just brings youth bear licenses in line with youth deer licenses. So that's what sections 21 and 22 are doing. Section 23, a year ago, I believe it was, we had proposed adding the issuing fee to the free licenses. There's a number of free licenses under statute for people with various disabilities or service veterans, things like that. And most licenses, there's a $1 issuing fee that the person selling the license collects. this went into effect, it created some issues, particularly with some of the disabled veteran licenses where we have to document their paperwork, and typically those are issued out of the central office, and people were sending in their paperwork and they weren't sending in their dollar. So, and it really makes no sense to send back their paperwork or, you know, spend time calling them up and saying, we can't process your license without your dollar. So, sure. So, and it's only $1,000, revenue impact of the, of this. So, so we're proposing to reinstate the $1 or to reinstate the no fee, no issuing fee for the free licenses with this section here. Section 24, eliminates a provision that the commissioner has to provide road authorities with standard forms for tracking wild animals that they pick up off the road. And that's another one of these outdated sections of statute. Section 25 to 27, this is a proposed change in policy related to trespass person knowingly entering land and being told to leave, making it clear that they can't re-enter that land the next day, that they can't return for a year after they've been personally notified not to do so.
So, Mr. Bogus, if we could, there's a question from Senator Hoffman here.
Sure. And I just heard Greg say that we addressed this last year, and I thought, does personally, I remember this conversation like it was yesterday. Maybe it was yesterday. Personally notified, that includes orally told, correct?
Mr. Knopf.
Senator Hoffman, yes. And it was in the Senate bill last year. It didn't survive over in the House, if I remember.
Oh, that's why. Because if I remember right, Mr. Chair, if I may, you were gone that day, and I was in front of Judiciary, and there was our law enforcement official, because I remember this going over and over, and we wanted to get to a birthday party, so it was like it happened yesterday, and I think he's here. So,
Lieutenant Colonel Smith would be glad to answer your questions.
I knew this was up last year, so let's – okay, now you explained why it died in the House. So, okay, thank you.
Thank you both. And, please, Mr. Bogus, proceed.
All right. Sections 28 and 29 just clarify that it's legal to use electronic range finders. They typically use a laser type form of light waves. And so just to make it clear that line 15.20, that's not a violation of this section for a person to use an electronic range finder from 1/2 hour before sunrise until sunset while lawfully hunting. It's been a little bit of a gray area, so we're just trying to clarify that. Section 30 is technical, just with the terminology around night vision and thermal imaging, just to make sure that all of that is covered.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Oster.
This is a killjoy. I can't use thermal imaging to nail that big 14-point buck. Killjoy. Thank you for the comedy interlude.
We're really sorry to disappoint you, Senator Osmick. Nonetheless, Mr. Bogus, please.
All right. Now, there's several sections here that relate back to the provisions that I talked about earlier relating to consolidating the authorities around small game. In order to do that, we had to kind of delete them in some places and reinsert them in other places. So sections 31, 32, 34, 39, 44 all relate to kind of this consolidation of small game. So here in section 31, it puts all the disturbing burrows or dens prohibitions into one section for dens of wild animals between November 1 and April 1, fox dens, raccoon dens, and before they were scattered in several different places. Section 32 similarly doesn't allow open fire or smoke to take protected wild animals or cutting trees to take protected wild animals. And this, can't remember for sure, this may be a little more broad than the original language, so there may be a little bit of a policy change here, not just a recodification of language. Section 33 then is on a different topic. I'll get back to some of the other small game ones as I go through, but section 33 would just eliminate the provision of the elk management plan statute that requires the plan to restrict elk to non-agricultural land in the state. Actually, the elk that are in the state now are in areas that could be classified as having significant agriculture. So we are trying to work with landowners. We're getting a lot of support for trying to address problems caused by elk and allow populations to increase and have tools to deal with elk when they cause problems. And there's getting to be more support, local support for increased elk populations, but some of that's going to mean that they may be expanding in some of the agricultural areas of the northwestern part of the state. Section 34, again, is back to the small game animals, and this is really the section that would put the general authorities for the commissioner for small game to just say the commissioner may by rule set open seasons for prescribed limits and restrictions on and designate areas where small game as defined in section 97A015 may be taken and possessed rather than doing it kind of species by species. And you'll see in the repealers that we've just eliminated a lot of those species by species in this bill. Sections 35 to 37 are technical, relate to reorganization, name changes within the Department of Natural Resources. Section 38 is actually some language we had worked with Senator Brown. I see he's gone, but last year we didn't end up getting it in a bill, but this is just to make it clear that a person dealing with Canada geese that are causing damage can scare, haze, chase, or harass those geese.
And Mr. Bogus, if you could just is this a complaint you get from folks around the state much? I mean, have you heard of the Canadian geese causing problems?
Mr. Chair, we do get a lot of complaints about geese causing problems, particularly because they go through a flightless stage beginning, in late May, early June. When the goslings are hatched, of course, they can't fly, and the adults also molt at that time, so they can't fly either because they're molting their flight feathers. So you have all these sometimes very large flocks of geese walking around feeding because they can't fly anywhere to feed, so they typically will nest in or near wetlands that have, they're grazers, so they like yards, they like golf courses, but they also like soybean fields, corn fields with, young plants. So they'll walk out of these wetlands into these fields and just start eating. And they can cause significant damage near those wetlands. So we do get quite a few complaints about that. We issue shooting permits. We do fencing to try to, since they can't fly, you can put little electric fences up, not very high, and they can't get through them. But it isn't clear under current law that people can go out there and do shell crackers or chase them or things like that. So we're just trying to clarify that's also an acceptable.
And is the term non-lethally haze, is that a technical term? I'm curious.
Well, I guess it's not defined, and this may be the first time we've used it, but we're trying to separate it from lethally haze, which would mean kill.
That's pretty clear what the intent there is. We'll have to ask Senator Brown what his idea of that, that concept is.
Well, yeah. Mr. Chair, considering he's not here, maybe we should get rid of this section just as payback for not staying through this. By the way, what is it, Mr. Chair, what is non-lethally scare? Do we put on a mask and say, ooh?
It could be what they call cracker shells that are, sure, you shoot them out of a shotgun, but they, sure, just are like a firecracker that shoots out and then explodes. Or it could be, propane guns that go off, or actually driving out there in a car or an ATV and trying to scare them away or chase them away. There are federal laws that don't allow you to harass migratory birds, so this is. But they make exceptions for resident Canada geese because they do recognize they cause significant problems. So we're just trying to make the state laws consistent with the federal.
Sure, and we know this is a serious issue. It's I guess been a long day, so we're getting a little squirrely here. You're doing a great job with the overview, and we're going to have to give Senator Brown a hard time here on this one, since he decided not to run his own bill this year and get into your technical bill here.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure he would have stuck around if he'd have known this was coming up.
Well, we can revisit this matter next Tuesday. So,
Mr. Chair, it looks like Section 38 means that we can bully them. Oh, hey, there you go.
Yeah, Mr. Bogus, please do proceed. Thank you for humoring us here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 39 I would consider it pretty technical. Just allowing the making it clear that the commissioner can prescribe the areas or zones for migratory birds in accordance with federal law. Section 40 and 41 are some new policy related to, Section 40 is related to invasive species training for minnow dealers and for people working under that minnow dealer's license that they need to satisfactorily complete aquatic invasive species training. This is online training, and that they have to have their certificate while they're taking, selling, or transporting minnows within the state. And then subdivision 3, because people under 18 can, leeches are classified as minnows under statute, but a person under 18 can trap and sell leeches without a minnow dealer's license. But if they're doing that, they would also be required to take this training. Section 41 is on commercial fish holding facilities. They have the ability right now when they commercially are fishing carp or whatever rough fish, they can put them in holding facilities. But there's no way right now that we know where they're doing that or how secure that is from other connectivity to other water. So on lines 19.2 to 19.4, it would require that they annually notify the commissioner of the legal description of those holding facilities and verify they have exclusive control of those. It's usually a wetland of some type or a small pond. And then subdivision 2, starting on line 19.9, requires that people with commercial fishing licenses and apprentices working under their license also must complete that aquatic invasive species training and must have the certificate when they're operating. Section 42 amends session law from 2008 that relates to shooting range appropriation out of the Heritage Enhancement Account in the Game and Fish Fund. And we've done some pre-design work related to that. There was $300,000 originally appropriated. I think about $30,000 of that's been spent. And the pre-design basically indicated that it would be very difficult to do a shooting sports facility as was originally envisioned in the metro area. So we'd like to be able to broaden the use of that existing appropriation to do smaller scale shooting ranges for basic hunter education, firearm safety, and archery ranges on public property. So we just want to repurpose some existing money that's been appropriated. Section 43 is what I talked about earlier when I was talking about the lifetime license fees that allows the commissioner to issue refunds for any of those licenses that were purchased at that higher fee between March 1 of last year and whenever those sections that correct those fees take effect. Section 44, currently the gray partridge limit is actually the same as the statutory limit, so all of our other game bird limits are actually already in rule, so this would just allow us an easy way to transfer that limit into rule as we're eliminating that statute as part of that small game consolidation. Section 45 would give the commissioner authority to amend the current rules on the issue I talked about earlier of making snowmobile and ATV rules during the deer season consistent. We put part of it, this bill would put part of it in statute earlier that I talked about shortly after I started. This would give the commissioner good cause exemption to then amend the rules to correspond to that. And then Section 46 relates to an issue with a trademark that the term conibear is it's a type of trap that catches an animal by the body rather than by the foot, but the term conibear is actually a trademark term. And so there's various places in statute that refer to body gripping or conibear type,
sure.
And the manufacturer has asked us to work on trying to stop using their trademark sure. name. So, and then the repealers, I don't know if you want to go through all the repealers, but...
we don't, unless members of the subcommittee feel it necessary to go through the repealers, if there's any highlights or things that might come up down the road, if you could just draw our attention to those. Otherwise, we can look over this and flag them for discussion next Tuesday, too.
Well, I might just point out one or two that could raise questions as people go through. A lot of the ones related to the lands are those old 30s, 40s types of things. And a lot of the things related to small game we've hit on as we go through here. And then some of this is just kind of unnecessary or obsolete. But there is one related to Muskie Lake designation that
H5R.
You might get people, either members or constituents, asking questions about. It's on page 5R97CO11. Okay. It's proposed to be repealed, and the reason for that isn't that we don't have, lakes we're managing for muskies. We do have lakes we're managing for muskies, but this section of statute is pretty old. Later on, we got... I think it's 97C001 and 97C005 allow us to do special and experimental regulations, and now all of our muskellunge lakes are done under those statutes, not under 97C011. And we're also getting rid of a lot of the spearing bans that were put on those lakes when they were originally designated as muskellunge lakes, because we're finding out that that's not necessary to manage for muskellunge. So that one I would just point out because people might ask about it. I think the rest of them are pretty self-explanatory.
And to your point, Mr. Boggess, in 97C.001, any concerns at all among the angling community, or should we expect that folks might be concerned by this, or is it just
Mr. Chair, we've heard from a couple of people who kind of misunderstood what this sure. was doing, that they thought we were not going to be designating or managing Muskie Lakes. That's not the case. So. When people understand that, they're fine. But I'm just bringing it up because it's confusing to people, because they know we have Muskie Lakes designated and managed, but we're doing it under 97C001 or 005 rather than 011.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, that's good. Any questions before we wrap up today? Otherwise, I'd just like to thank DNR for the overviews and giving us a preview of the bill here. For purposes of planning, this subcommittee is planning to get together at the same time, same place, next Tuesday. We'll hear member bills, so if you haven't submitted a hearing request, please get that to us. And then the plan right now is to meet in G15 next Thursday at the same time and pass out an omnibus bill. So with that said, we're adjourned till Tuesday.
Thank you.